You're listening to Hear Arizona, addressing issues, empowering our community.
It's hard to think of a natural phenomenon as menacing and threatening as fire. It is, after all, a common way to think of hell, a fiery place of eternal suffering. And that conception of fire, particularly wildfire, makes some sense. It's true that wildfires pose a real threat. They destroy buildings and burn down forests. But fire is also an essential and very natural feature of life on Earth. Certain kinds of fires are completely healthy for the environment. But those aren't the kinds of fires you see on the news.
Massive fires.
An apocalyptic sight in Australia.
12 million acres scorched.
The massive bushfires now visible from space.
The desperate battle to contain California's historic fires.
The orange glow from wildfires burning miles away, shrouding the city's landmarks, the smoke blocking out the sun.
It feels like the end of the world. It's pretty scary.
Hotter summers mean fire season is up to 80 days longer than it used to be, and intensifying droughts turn the landscape into a tinderbox ready to ignite at the first spark. Between 1983 and 92, wildfires, on average, burned about 2.5 million acres per year across the U.S. In the last decade, they've burned over 7 million per year. And the wildfires we're seeing today are different from those we saw even just a few decades ago. They're bigger, hotter, and they spread faster. In this episode, you'll hear from a lot of people who fight these fires for a living.
You know, I look at the fires now, the last 20 years, and those are angry fires. These are fires that grow faster. They're harder to catch.
With fires that move slower, you had more time to get out of the way, and now the way they're moving, you have to make sure you're anticipating that so you can get to a safe area in a timely manner. I remember one fire in Washington, you know, running down the highway, down a paved road with bears and deer running with us.
Yeah, you stick around in the job long enough, like you're going to have close calls that you're just like, wow, I could have punched my ticket today and not gone home.
We've been from the tip of South America, you know, to Northern Alaska, and the same problems exist, you know, at all points in between.
How did we get to this point? Where are we headed? What can we do about it? These are all questions we'll explore in our next three episodes of Inhospitable. In this first episode, we'll focus on how wildfires have changed in recent years, because they've not only gotten larger and more common, they've also gotten more dangerous. We'll hear from the firefighters that risk their lives to put fires out. It takes extraordinary courage, technology, and physical labor to save people, buildings, and the natural landscape from fire. And as the fires grow, our country's firefighting force is struggling to keep up. And the stakes are high.
You know, right now we're on a train wreck. You know, absolutely. So if we do not curb greenhouse gas emissions, all bets are off for a lot of our western forests.
From Here, Arizona, this is Inhospitable. I'm Anthony Wallace. If you could, just for the sake of the recorder, introduce yourself, say your name and your title.
Sure. My name is Susan Pritchard, and I'm a research scientist with University of Washington School of Environmental and Forest Sciences.
When a wildfire happens, there's usually one statistic the news uses to describe it.
40-acre fire.
180 acres have burned.
1,000-acre wildfire.
20,000 acres.
200,000 square acres.
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 Its size, in acres. That's an important metric, and it's plain to see that the number of acres burned every year is going up and up. But according to Susan Pritchard and a lot of other fire experts I spoke to, acreage alone does not paint the full picture.
One of the things that has disturbed me just in reading popular media is this idea that with climate change, there are projections for more area burned. And I actually think that's absolutely true. Our question is more about how are those fires going to burn? Historically, we had really large fires. A lot more of those fires burned at low to mixed severity.
To really understand what wildfires are doing today, we have to look at their severity. Low severity fires tend to smolder on the forest floor with scattered small flames that resemble a campfire. They can actually be good for the forest. They're completely natural and don't pose a serious threat to most trees. High severity fires, on the other hand, burn at temperatures that can reach over 2,000 degrees, with flames that can reach over 100 feet tall. They kill almost everything in their path, and they pose an existential threat to forests.
What we're noticing now, though, is that high severity is burning a lot more of these landscapes, more than what we can really afford if we want to have old and mature forests out there.
Pritchard mentioned work done by the researchers Sean Parks of the U.S. Forest Service and John Abatskalou of the University of California, Merced. They used satellite imagery to quantify how the severity of wildfires in the United States western forests has changed in the past 40 years. The way they did their analysis, the more trees and other foliage left after a fire, the less severely it burned. And they found that between 1985 and 2017, the average area of forest that burned at high severity each year increased by a factor of 8.
We often talk about the 1988 Yellowstone fires as just being representative of this new era of wildfires. Historically, Yellowstone and other areas definitely had large wildfires, but this era of large wildfires across the Western United States is marked, and it's definitely been accelerating. 2000 through 2010 kept on breaking records, and we have not stopped in terms of fire area or often the severity of the fires.
That study also found that high severity burning was especially common during fire seasons that were hotter and drier, two of the most fundamental symptoms of climate change. It also stressed that as climate change progresses, the high severity burning could get worse. And when the burning gets frequent and severe enough, the forest has a hard time recovering. That could mean that western forests covered in big trees eventually turn into rolling plains that look more like Scotland than Yellowstone.
We are already seeing areas, especially in the southwestern U.S., where there used to be forests, and then the post-fire environments after a high-severity fire are turning into persistent grasslands or shrublands. If we have unchecked climate change, all bets are off for so many of our forests, and I don't even like to envision it because I love forests.
Susan Pritchard doesn't only know wildfires from the detached perspective of a scientist. She also knows them as a concerned homeowner, community member, and mother. She told me that after she earned her PhD in the early 2000s, she and her wife moved out of Seattle and into the forest.
We found ourselves in a little valley in eastern Washington that is great for recreation. What I didn't anticipate was that this area in north central Washington state would have just incredible amount of wildfires. And I will say that when I moved over here, I was actually intellectually excited about that possibility. So we moved into the valley in 2004. And then fast forward a couple of years, 2006, it looked like a nuclear bomb had exploded out in the wilderness of the Pusaten area, basically.
The 2006 tripod fire threatened her home and filled her valley with smoke that lingered for months.
Having the sky absolutely smoke-filled and the sun literally red, those days are just gloomy and horrifying in that there's no way, unless you drive out of it, to escape the fact that smoke is literally creeping in every nook and cranny of your house.
Wildfire smoke contains tiny harmful particles. Multiple studies have shown that it exacerbates asthma symptoms. And it's also been linked to respiratory infections like bronchitis and even heart attacks and strokes. The smoke was so bad that summer that Susan took her family to her parents' home near Seattle to escape it. But over the years, the fires have just kept coming.
So as I look out my door, last summer's wildfire that we had burned within a mile of our house. So these wildfires are not, you know, in the distant hills anymore. They've really been burning quite close to town. And we're part of the fabric of a community. And so it's very hard to imagine leaving. So even though we don't like summer anymore, the other seasons are still good enough to stay.
So when you experience the fire firsthand, there is a shift. Initially, you're intellectually excited about being close to the fire, but then kind of a more emotional reality hit, it seems like.
Absolutely. And I would say that when the 2014 Carlton Complex fire burned through, for me personally, that was where I was truly worried that people were going to lose their lives in a wind-driven summer wildfire event. And I still get choked up about it. With 310 homes were destroyed in that fire. People really had their livelihoods and their property changed. And so that was one of those fires that was a game changer for me, because it devastated our community for a while. There's no other word for it.
Hotter temperatures and less rain are not the only reasons wildfires are getting worse. According to a lot of experts I talked to, we've also mismanaged forests in the past century or so, not letting enough lower severity fires burn that can naturally thin out the forest, removing fuel that allow megafires to rapidly spread. We'll dive into that topic on another episode. But on the climate front, there are other factors, like more lightning-caused fires and increasing populations of warm weather-loving bark beetles that are killing trees and making them more flammable.
Now we have all that fuel that's been dead for 10 years just ready to go up like a tinderbox.
This is a wildland firefighter for the United States Forest Service. We'll call him Jay.
Cool. Yeah, and just because I'm still in the agency, if it's okay, I'd like to remain anonymous.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Like Susan, Jay has come face to face with hot burning and dangerous wildfires. And I wanted to talk to him because his story shows how, in this new era of increasingly severe wildfires, our nation's great firefighting operation, with all its manpower, machinery, and aircraft, seems to be overwhelmed and outmatched. That's also why he wanted to stay anonymous.
You know, we're seeing all these fires that there's nothing you can do. You know, they're going to burn. Colorado, you know, I think 2 years ago, they had three of the largest fires in wildfire history in 1 year. And, you know, we have staffing shortages across the entire agency. So we're trying to catch bigger fires with less people.
The U.S. Forest Service's staffing challenges have been well publicized. One representative of the agency told me that as of May, it had about 10,000 wildland firefighters employed, 90% of its target workforce. But in some places, like the Pacific Northwest, it only has about 3/4 of its target. They said that part of this has to do with the labor issues that exist all over the country. Companies everywhere are having a hard time hiring people. But a major part of the problem for the U.S. Forest Service is low pay. some wildland firefighters make as little as $15 an hour, the federal minimum wage. I reached out to Jay on the message board site Reddit, where he wrote a post that got a lot of attention on a page dedicated to wildland firefighters. He wrote, quote, "Welp, I'm going to spend the rest of the day updating my resume, because I'm done. The Forest Service is going to lose all of their good employees, and I'm humble, but I know I'm one of them."
So currently I'm working as a senior on a helitech crew. It's called A-STAR. It's a light helicopter. This is going to be my ninth year in fire.
Jay is 31 years old, and by now, he's a veteran firefighter.
I love the job. I've made awesome friends that I'm still in contact with from 8 years ago. It's kind of a joke we said on the crew, but like you're all suffering together. You know what I mean? You know, it's the time commitment and money that doesn't add up with not wanting to stick around.
Talking to Jay, I was blown away by how intense a job wildland firefighting is.
We'll work 14 days on, and then we get 3 days off. I had a couple assignments where just with scheduling, I had to work. I think I worked a 21 day last year. And then like a mixture of like 18, 19 days every once in a while.
Before Jay was on the helicopter, he was on a hotshot crew. They're groups of around 20 firefighters that get sent all over the country to fight the toughest wildfires. So being in a hotshot crew means tons of driving. Jay said when he was based in Arizona, they drive to Florida, Idaho, Montana, and those days driving do not count as working days. So if it takes 3 days to drive, those are your 3 days off.
Most of the time on hotshots, it's 16 hours on, 8 hours off. Yeah, like we would wake up at 06, go to breakfast, get in the trucks, drive to the fire line, typically work till about 8 or 9 at night, sometimes more, get back to incident command, and we would eat dinner, go to bed, 14 days in a row.
This work is so physically demanding. He said he started training 2 or 3 months before fire season started, running, lifting weights, doing push-ups and burpees. He said most days started with a serious hike through the forest just to get to the fire, with a ton of weight on his back.
I was lead saw for 2 years on the crew I was on, and overall, you're carrying like 65 pounds of weight for however many miles to get to the fire, and then you don't take that weight off all day. You're carrying it the whole time, and then you're working. So chainsaws, you know, they're heavy, and you're cutting all day, either, you know, 10, 12 hours.
A big part of fighting wildfires is making a fire line, a break in the foliage that will hopefully stop the fire in its tracks and contain it. That takes digging through grass, cutting down trees, and removing limbs and brush from the ground. And as you can probably guess, doing all this right next to a raging fire is not only exhausting, but dangerous. Between 1990 and 2019, over 500 firefighters died fighting wildfires in the United States.
Yeah, you stick around in the job long enough, like you're going to have close calls that you're just like, wow, I could have punched my ticket today and not gone home.
This is Jonathan Golden. Now he works as a consultant advocating for fire policy at local, state, and federal levels. But he was on the front lines in his younger years, working on hotshot crews like Jay. And he has a few harrowing memories from those days.
I was crossing a scree slope and I asked somebody to kind of watch my back because there was a tree that I had to go around. And yeah, that thing came down right as I was crossing under it, and my partner yelled out to me, and had he not been there, it would have got me for sure.
Another time he was in a canyon in Idaho. A fire was fast approaching him and 3 other firefighters. They could either hold their ground and deploy their fire shelters, which are thin covers made of heat-resistant material, or escape down a steep cliff behind them.
It was very, very scary. I'm not going to pretend I wasn't scared, because I was scared. It was a topic of discussion amongst the four of us, whether or not we should deploy. And we took a gamble on descending down a cliff. Descending is really a polite term. I ended up falling and tumbling down a cliff, and steep slope. I'm really surprised I didn't break any bones. And, you know, the whole time the helicopter was flying above us, trying to find a spot to just put a skid down where we could jump in. And yeah, we ran 5 miles downstream to get out of there. And, you know, what started off as a single tree fire, by the time we got out of there, had, you know, blown up into, I think the air tax said about a couple hundred acres.
The fires are burning hotter. The fire behavior is such that they're much more difficult to suppress and manage. There's only so much we can do when a fire is running through the crowns of the trees. You know, it's not safe to put people in front of it.
This is Reva Duncan, another former wildland firefighter. She recently retired after a 31-year firefighting career with the U.S. Forest Service.
The longer we stay in it, we lose friends. We're involved in fatalities, critical incidents, serious injuries. You know, when you're young and inexperienced, a lot of it's like, oh, that was fun. Oh, we made it. And it's only later that you realize how close you came to a really bad outcome. And then you start wondering why you can't sleep, right? Or why your temper is so short, or, you know, things that didn't bother you before, why they're bothering. And because those kinds of after effects of a traumatic experience or just the cumulative can happen way down the road, you know, weeks or months. And so, you know, we're trying to address those better and prepare firefighters to deal with those ahead of time, right?
Today, Reva works with Grassroots Wildland Firefighters, a nonprofit organization that supports wildland firefighters across the country. Both she and Jonathan Golden advocate for better mental health care for wildland firefighters. According to Reva's organization, the suicide rate for people in the profession is 30 times higher than the general public. All this seems really bleak, but all the firefighters I talked to said the same thing. They love this job. They love the camaraderie, the challenge. They love feeling like they're making a difference. They just need more support from the federal government. Reva and Jonathan both enthusiastically support TIMS Act, a bill named after a recently killed firefighter that is working its way through Congress now. It would give firefighters a significant raise, better mental health care, and other benefits. That bill's fate is unclear. However, Congress's November 2021 infrastructure bill included $600 million for wildland firefighter raises. But for bureaucratic reasons, by the time 2022's fire season started, none of those pay raises had actually gone into effect.
We've had people retire early because they're like, I just can't wait anymore. It's not worth it to me. So, you know, we're more than 6 months past the date of the passage of the law, and people haven't seen the money yet. So a lot of frustration with that. And I think we're at a breaking point. I think we're all at a breaking point with it. A lot of experienced firefighters leaving federal service because of the lack of pay and benefits, those are the people with that critical experience that we're losing. And that worries me. That worries me about who's left out there on the fire line with less experience and not being able to adapt to the, you know, conditions we're seeing right now.
Spent a couple days updating my resume and looking for new opportunities. It's just we've been told over and over and over that, you know, we love our firefighters, we're going to take care of you. And they've dangled carrots in front of us for however many years saying that it's going to change, and then it doesn't. The future, I'd like to be in fire, but I'm just done being away for 8 months and not getting paid well to do it. The time and money part of it just doesn't make sense anymore.
This again is Jay. And low pay is what drove him to post in frustration to Reddit. Jay told me his base salary is $33,000 a year. He said he did work 1,000 hours of overtime last year, which is like working an extra 25 full work weeks in the space of 1 year. So that made him an extra $25,000 or so. But when he doesn't get overtime, he said he barely makes enough money to cover his monthly mortgage, let alone all the other stuff he needs to get by. He told me that when he started out, his base salary was more like $22,000 a year, and he only worked 6 months out of the year, so that really came out to around $11,000. Both Jay and Jonathan Golden told me that when they were only working half the year, they'd have to find random part-time jobs in the winter at restaurants or doing construction to get by. After I talked to Jay and Reva, the Biden administration announced it would finally follow through on the infrastructure bill and give firefighters a big raise of up to 50% of their salary. That is, at least for the next 2 years. They'll need a more permanent solution to extend the raise past that. Time will tell how the raise will impact staffing shortages. But for now, Jay said everyone is working harder and taking on more responsibilities. His particular unit is understaffed, so he has to do the job of a higher-ranking, higher-paid firefighter. But he isn't compensated for that.
It makes everything harder. And then, you know, having to work longer days because we don't have people to staff the ship. Having to work more. It's just, you know, it is what it is.
Jay told me in a message that he still plans on leaving his job despite the pay raises. At this point, it seems like he's lost most of his faith in the U.S. Forest Service.
No, I think their motivation and their priorities have become obvious. And yeah, I think a lot's going to be said when they lose a lot of their workforce, and good luck. Yeah.
So it could get, seems like it's on track to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, that is my prediction.
To be fair, the U.S. Forest Service is constrained by their budget, and they're up against forces of nature too big for any one human institution to handle. In 2021, Reva Duncan testified to Congress remotely over video call. She was emotional, and her message was powerful.
I have driven a good friend to rehab. I have held onto a firearm for another friend who was afraid they would use it on themselves. And I have escorted the body of a fallen firefighter home to their family. In closing, I am not here to disparage the U.S. Forest Service. These issues are larger than any one agency and will take complex and expensive solutions. It truly was my honor to serve the U.S. Forest Service and the American people. I loved working in fire, but I love the people I work with even more. I have grown weary of losing amazing friends and colleagues, and I have grown impatient with inaction. The U.S. is burning, wildland firefighters are struggling, and some are even dying. The time for reform is now. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there are shortages in every aspect of it. Yeah, it's taking more people. It's taking more aviation resources, more ground resources, more dozers, yeah, more caterers, more everything.
This is John Gold. He's been fighting fires his whole adult life, since the mid-1970s. And for most of that time, he's been doing it from the air.
You know, I look at the fires now, the last 20 years, and those are angry fires. These are fires that grow faster. They're harder to catch. You know, you look at the perimeter of these fires today, they're 100% active all the way around it. And it's just burning really hot, burning it all up, and just gorging the earth. So there's a much heavier reliance on aviation-based resources to help these firefighters on the ground because they need the help. It's, you know, those fires are burning hotter.
I wanted to talk to John because he oversees the most powerful firefighting tool the Forest Service has at its disposal. He's the CEO of 10 Tanker, an Albuquerque-based company with a fleet of 4 converted DC-10 air tankers. Their planes can drop over 9,000 gallons of red-colored fire retardant on the perimeter of a fire, which can help establish the fire line. Last year, they dropped 12 million gallons of retardant, a record for the company.
We see that the amount of use that we get every year has gone up on a pretty steep curve, you know, pretty much year to year. And that's because there's more fire out there.
And when fires die down in the U.S. in the wintertime, they take their planes to the Southern Hemisphere.
Then from the tip of South America, you know, to Northern Alaska. And the same problems exist, you know, at all points in between. This year, again, we're fighting fires in Coahuila, Mexico. Same thing. A beautiful pine forest at 10,000, you know, 8 to 10,000 feet that they just never had fires there before. And this is the second year in a row that we've been down there. So, yeah, it's happening everywhere.
So it's not just like places that have always had fires getting worse fires. It's now places that have never had fires getting fires.
That's correct. Yeah. The Amazon. You know, I mean, you see how many fires are burning in the Amazon. No one would have considered that a real fire hotspot years ago, but seems to be.
The other thing I was wondering, I know this is really just a very big ask, but if there's any possible way for me to actually ride in the plane.
As far as riding in it, no, there's no way.
No, well, that's what I thought, but wanted to ask.
Hey, might as well throw it out there, right?
Yeah.
Don't ask, you don't get it.
Worth a try.
Yeah.
Okay. John said I could get the next best thing, though, a visit with the plane and the crew on the ground. He told me one of their planes was currently based out of the Mesa Gateway Airport in the Phoenix area, so I went to check it out.
Yeah, I'm Dan.
Anthony,
nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Just find a spot over there, then I'll meet you over there.
Sounds good.
The plane's captain, Dan Montelli, lets me into the gate of the special air tanker base section of the airport, which mostly functions as a normal airport with commercial flights. The 10 tanker DC-10s have 3-man crews, a captain, co-pilot, and flight engineer.
And then this is my crew right here, Gage Lowry, he's a flight engineer.
How you doing, Gage?
I'm Anthony.
Anthony, how you doing? Nice to meet you.
Hi, Anthony, I'm Todd.
Hey.
Nice to meet you.
The air tanker base is like a fire station with planes instead of trucks. There's a giant projector screen playing ESPN in a workout area. At any moment, any of the flight crews can be summoned to a fire. I arrived at 9 a.m., just as everyone is about to attend a briefing by the U.S. Forest Service.
Southern Area PL2, 9 new fires, 0 new large incidents, 1 uncontained large fire. 1 in Texas, looks like we've got that one wrapped. For aircraft, they still have the scoopers all committed in Calf Canyon fire. And that's going to be a wrap for us there.
After the briefing, the crew's engineer, Gage, lets me know it's a somewhat quiet fire day. But there is one big one in southern Arizona near the Mexican border.
And there was three or four of them that were up there, the ones we've been working on, the Calf Canyon up near in New Mexico, and this Elgin Bridge that just cranked off a couple of days ago down right above Sierra Vista out of Fort Huachuca. So that kind of popped up. So that's what we kind of look at when they're looking at, hey, what's going on in the country.
Outside on the tarmac are a number of firefighting aircraft operated by other companies. There's a 737, a couple big jets, and a few smaller propeller planes. Maintenance people and others manning the retardant refill station are busy getting ready for the day. Finally, I make it to the biggest plane of them all, the 10-tanker DC-10. It actually kind of makes the 737 look tiny in comparison. This particular plane was built in the 1980s and once flew passengers, as many as 380 at a time. The crew told me theirs is the largest active fire tanker plane in the world. Gage said the firefighters on the ground affectionately call the plane Big Juicy. The 10 tanker fleet are the first DC-10s to ever be converted to fire tankers.
Yeah, the company spent about $30 million of their own money coming up with this.
I rode up a mobile lift to the doorway of the airplane. It looks nothing like it did when it carried people around.
So you can see how everything here has pretty much been kind of gutted to get the aircraft as light as it can.
The plane isn't always pressurized, so the pilots try to stay under 12,000 feet, and they have oxygen masks always at the ready. There are no seats in the cabin, no proper floor or ceiling. There's lots of exposed metal and wiring, and enough empty space to run around or play catch with a baseball.
So we're quite lighter than what the max is. So we've got great performance, great maneuverability. People don't realize how maneuverable the same plane is, and even in the fire area. So
that maneuverability is important. They fly close by mountains and into valleys to get the retardant where it needs to go. And when they drop it, they fly low to the ground at only 250 feet and relatively slow at around 170 miles per hour. They're so low, in fact, Gage told me that they had to take out the system in the cockpit that warns them they're about to hit the ground because it would go off on them during normal drops. It's a job that requires precision. The retardant needs to hit the ground just right.
If you're too low, if you're too fast, it'll do what it calls shadowing. It'll hit only like one side of the tree, and now the other side is susceptible to lighting off again.
Dan and Gage are experienced and accomplished aviators. And like all the other firefighters I talked to, they love this job.
You know, I've been in, you know, Desert Storm. I've been in Panama. I've been airplanes shot at and done emergency reliefs and all that. And it tops up to me, it tops up to those things. You know, when you're doing something to help people on the ground, it's a good feeling.
But then, you know, for pilot-wise, you know, this is probably the best job ever, you know, flying low, big airplane like this, you know. But then at the same time, you know, you're watching forests burn, houses burn. You take a lot of pride in putting the retardant, you know, where it needs to go to help the guys on the ground, helping everybody out, you know, on the ground to stop the fire. But as far as for a pilot, it's the best job, but then it's the worst job too, because, you know, you're seeing things burn up, and it's kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. Both Gage and Dan have flown in the DC-10 tanker in other countries, like Chile, Australia, and Mexico. All the planes at the air tanker base are directed by the U.S. Forest Service. When the agency decides to use them, they get a piece of paper with the coordinates on it, and they rush to get the plane started and filled up with retardant. From the time they get their orders to the time they take off is only about 20 minutes. As we were talking, the other planes at the base started revving their engines and rolling down the taxiway.
There is a fire going on right now down in southern, near Nogales somewhere. And 03, the one that's in our pit, is the first up. So he'll, once he moves, then we'll push back and then get cranked over.
Where's Paul? Get Paul and everybody out. I'll crank up the APU. Okay, so I'm gonna crank up.
As the plane was getting powered up and the firefighting base was kicking into action, I thought about what they're up against. I thought about something the 10 tanker CEO John Gold told me a few days earlier. Because when you see just how much more intense and destructive wildfires are getting, and how increasingly outmatched our firefighters are in putting them out, it's only natural to wonder, how much worse can it get? Where is this going in the future?
Yeah, I don't know where it will end. You know, what I worry about, I'm a kid of the Western United States that grew up in, the coniferous forests of Western Montana. And so the root problem is, again, it's getting warmer, it's getting drier. So not only do I worry about all of our coniferous forest burning, I also worry about what's going to come back in their place. You know, these forests that are burning in Arizona and New Mexico, beautiful pine stands, what replaces them? I don't know that we have the answers to that yet. But, you know, what we know about what's happening in California is that, you know, whatever burns, what replaces it is, you know, finer fuels, grasses, whatever comes back, it seems like it's receptive to fire and the fires will burn again.
John Gold told me that, in his opinion, the Forest Service's firefighting budget is stuck in a time when fires were less massive and threatening than they are today. Talking to him, I got the sense that if the budget were larger, there'd be even more DC-10s dropping more retardant, because there are plenty of fires to put out. And so, one by one, the fire tankers at Mesa Gateway Airport took off to try to slow down the fire near Mexico, to try to save the wilderness and people and animals and buildings down there, at least for today. Thank you so much for listening. And to be sure you don't miss our future episodes, subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen. If this episode sparked your curiosity or inspired you to take action yourself, you can find more information on the organizations we profiled and the issues they face on our website, hearArizona.org. That's H-E-A-R Arizona. There, you can also find our other podcast series on the most pressing challenges our state faces, like homelessness, aging, and funding for the arts. One of the best ways to support our community-based solutions journalism is to tell your friends about it. They can search for Hear Arizona on their favorite podcast listening app, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, Spotify. And since we're all about empowering our community, we want you to be a part of the conversation. Follow Hear Arizona on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Special thanks to Susan Pritchard, Reva Duncan, Jonathan Golden, and Ten Tanker for their help with this episode. This series is in part supported by Intel, committed to creating a more responsible, inclusive, and sustainable future for Arizona. Intel.com/Arizona. This podcast series is made possible by grants from the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust and the Arizona Community Foundation. Hear Arizona is a production of the Division of Public Service at Rio Salado College, which includes Sun Sounds, Spot 127, KBOC, and KJZZ. This episode was reported, written, scored, and hosted by me, Anthony Wallace. It was edited by KJZZ's Carrie Fair Snyder. Linda Pastore is our executive producer.